You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
Hey guys, if you like radically honest true stories, you'll love the hit true storytelling podcast, Risk. Risk is the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. Stories too uncensored for public radio. Nothing's too intimate or too loaded. Stories on Risk are sometimes hilarious, sometimes scary, and sometimes truly beautiful. Like the one about the guy who cooked and served his own leg to his friends as tacos, or the one where a woman's manic episode had her thinking she was living through a real-life Truman Show. These stories are told with so much compassion and emotional intelligence, it's inspiring. And just recently, Monster Talk guest David Halperin told the story about his first UFO landing investigation as a teenager and the very unexpected alien encounter that followed.
As my fellow ufologists and I unraveled the secrets of the UFOs, it was likely we would discover the secrets of their propulsion. And as that happened, I would probably be able to design and build for myself a functional flying saucer. And then girls might go out with me.
You can find David's story in the recent episode Close Encounters of the First Part, and he returns to discuss a UFO experiencer's incredible story in Close Encounters of the Second Part. You can find these and every other Risk episode wherever you get podcasts or at risk-show.com. That's R-I-S-K or risk-show.com. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Food with Mark Bittman, Big Picture Science, and Fork in the Road. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. You can enjoy extended commercial-free versions of this show by joining us at patreon.com/monstertalk, all one word, M-O-N-S-T-E-R-T-A-L-K. For as little as $2 a month, you can enjoy longer interviews, unbleeped language, and bonus episodes exclusive for patrons. And if $2 a month is not workable for you, but you still want to help out, be sure and leave us a positive review on your podcasting platform of choice. iTunes reviews in particular can help bring in new listeners, and your positive reviews really make a difference. If you want to learn other ways to help out, visit monstertalk.org/support, where you can find even more ways to help keep this show going. Thank you to all of you who are supporting us with your hard-earned money and valuable time. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or even exceed your expectations.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster. Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. I'm feeling some better, but Team Smith and Team Stolzner are both experiencing health issues this week, so we're pulling one from the archives. This is an audio presentation from our YouTube series, Debased on a True Story, where we examine films that are alleged to be based on real, usually paranormal, events. This week's episode looks at the 1983 film, The Entity, starring Barbara Hershey and Ron Silver. It's based on the 1978 novel, The Entity, by Frank DeFelitta, inspired by the experiences of Doris Bither in 1974, who claims to have been sexually assaulted by invisible entities in her home. Due to the nature of the story, you should know that we try to be sensitive to the topic, even though we're critical of the authenticity of the story. If you're deeply affected by stories of sexual trauma, like this one, you might want to skip it. But we did think it was important to cover this famous story, whether it's a ghost story, a demon story, an alien story, or a mental illness story. Whatever it is, it was traumatic to the people involved, and we do appreciate that. However, it was also a major motion picture that presented the material uncritically, and we have some stuff to say about that. There are several photos discussed in this episode, which you won't be able to see unless you watch the video or check the show notes, but the underlying ideas, I think, come across pretty well. I'll put some of those photos in the show notes, but I don't want to remove that section of the audio just because you can't see the photos. Also, if it's not apparent, this will be a very spoilerific episode. We will be spoiling surprises in the film. But I hope you enjoy it. And there's lots of other episodes in our Debased on a True Story series, which you can find at monstertalk.org, or you can find it at youtube.com/monstertalk.
Monster Talk.
Welcome, everyone, for another episode of Debased on a True Story. My name is Matthew Baxter.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
And I'm Blake Smith. And today we're covering the 1982 film and associated book, The Entity.
Yay.
We had 1983, so I don't know.
Oh, I think it came out in 82. I think IMDb says 82 anyway.
Okay. Well, I think that's an interesting kind of metaphor for this entire film and the story behind it, that facts and dates and names and things seem to change. So,
and let's kick this off with a great big old trigger warning, because
this movie could not be made today.
It could not. It could hardly be enjoyed today.
It can hardly be watched today. Yes,
it's a thing. It's a thing. But it deals with a lot of really. You know, we talk about a lot of things, murder and all that sort of stuff, and death and horror and ghosts and people being chopped up and eaten. But this is a movie largely about sexual assault, and that's the nicest way to put it.
It is, and I think that the producer and the director said at some point, "Oh, this is not a horror; this is a suspense or a thriller film." I think it's certainly got aspects of horror to it.
It was horrible in that sense. I mean, it was very triggering to watch in this day and age. It was. It was difficult to get through a lot of those scenes. And
like I had to break it up.
So did we.
I broke it up to like three sessions. And I can't, this would be a terrible date movie.
Funny you should say that, because I think Matt and I watched it very early on in our relationship.
Woo the women's.
It's a something.
But I think that like this was your first viewing, wasn't it?
It was. Now I've been aware of it.
We forgot to tell you, Blake. We were going to say, don't watch this with your children.
Yeah, no kid. Well, yeah, I knew that. I knew the subject matter. I mean, I've been deliberately avoiding the movie just out of the sense of, and it's not because I didn't think I could handle it. I've seen many films that were deeply exploitative, and I mean.
Cannibal Holocaust. Talked about some of them.
I Spit on Your Grave.
A Serbian film.
I haven't watched that, but I'm very familiar with that.
Heard Hostel. Of it? Yeah, I know the plot. Yeah. I don't want to see it.
Yeah. Well, and right, and it's this film is not as it's not as titillating and sensational as those. I mean, it does approach the stuff very seriously, mm-hmm. and I was very impressed. with the acting of Barbara Hershey. Your job, part of this job as an actress, is to present a story about a woman who's being raped by something that's invisible. And mm-hmm. she has to convey that. So the director and the way that the film was approached, I think they probably did as good as they could. It wasn't, I didn't find it laughable. I found it disturbing. And I think that maybe was the
very
goal.
Very disturbing, very distressing. And I have to add too, you mentioned Barbara Hershey. So some original contenders for that role include Sally Fields and Jane Fonda and Bette Midler. I really can't imagine any of them in that role.
Although Barbara Hershey and Bette Midler apparently did work together later on some film called Beaches, according to my wife. So
that's yes.
Yeah, I think that's the only other
Barbara Hershey film that I've seen. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so to see that and then to see this is quite a different role.
Yeah. And Sally Field would, the lines would have changed. It would have been more like, you don't really like me. It just... I don't think
that was lost on Blake.
No. I do know the story of I remember the Oscars.
It just wasn't funny.
It just was not funny at all.
No, I was just thinking about Beaches and that song, "The Wind Beneath My Wings," I don't want you to have to edit this. So we're just going to leave out the joke that was in my head. So yeah. Well, but
did you ever know that you're my hero?
Like, yeah, exactly. Because Kathleen actually did say, did you ever know that she was in Beaches? I did not.
Well, I think we should start by saying that in the movie, there are certainly a lot of differences between the movie and the true story.
Yes.
And one of those is that the main character, Barbara, played by Barbara Hershey, is Carla Moran instead of Doris Bither. Bither. Yeah. I keep saying Bither, but Bither. I think that I don't know how quickly we want to jump into this, but Matt made a really interesting point when we were rewatching the movie again last night, and that is that the woman that they present in the movie is a lot more well-adjusted.
Likeable.
She has a job and she's, I think, attending college, and the home life seems to be relatively happy, and she is just well dressed and basically more likable than the character in the true story.
Right, and this was written by Frank DiFelitta, who had written the novel The Entity,
1978,
which is based on the work of the parapsychologists we'll get into all that, but he's also famous.
74. The true story's in 74. The book was written in 78, and then the movie 82, 83.
Yeah.
But have you read the book then?
I've read chunks of it. I found it online and read little pieces of it here and there, and it was interesting. And it's got and it's interesting also because the film has been, I guess, recognized by feminists as being a film with a lot of feminist themes. I certainly felt it was a film in which women's exploitation and victimization is a big part of the plot, and her rising up and trying to fight this stuff is it's a very woman against a lot, not just the system, but the ghosts and that sort of theme is running through the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, certainly there are just so many men in this movie, from the psychologist through to her boyfriend, through to her own children or her son, because she obviously had him, I think, at the age of 16, according to the movie. So, and she's 30. And then through to the paranormal researchers too. There's just a lot of men pulling her in different directions. And she's
really...
And then
the entity itself.
And the entity itself, which I guess is portrayed in the movie as being some kind of invisible assailant, although you do catch glimpses of it. And that has parallels to the true life story too, where... I mean, we've heard different versions, haven't we, Matt? That
this
entity was a man, or it was three men, maybe one very large and powerful and strong man, and two smaller men who would hold her down during the assault. Through to, I think one story said that they were Asian men, so I don't know where that came from.
That was part of her testimony, apparently. Was she
How did she discern that?
Yeah, I don't know, and I don't want to know. Like, there's nowhere that goes this good. There's nowhere that goes this good.
No. It is interesting that for her to discern that, it seems like throughout, I think that's the paranormal, one of the paranormal elements of the movie, that she does give descriptions and she seems to be able to determine when this thing is going to appear and what it's going to do. So there is some kind of almost like a psychic ability that she has at times.
So I just wanted to mention, though, that Frank DiFelitta, who wrote the novel and wrote this screenplay, mm-hmm. is also well known for having written the novel Audrey Rose, which was about reincarnation. And it was a very popular reincarnation novel in the 70s, which there were a few of those, which is 70s were weird. So to be blunt, the 70s in California in particular were weird. And this all happens in that sort of paranormal new agey milieu, as they say. It's coming out of a culture where ghosts and psychic powers and self-help and meditation and EST and all these weird sort of ideas are all, there's a stew of that going on at the time when this is put together. Sorry. So we'll hop back to the movie now, but I think it's interesting that he had sort of made a couple, like this was kind of his Poltergeist novel, and coincidentally comes out in 82. Not as widely or as well regarded as Poltergeist, I think, but it's, if you you get two movies about the same idea, and man, did you get the feeling there was a little bit of Annabelle, the creation stuff going on here too, where like the bookstore scenes, I didn't think of that,
but I think, now that you put it that way, I think that is a bit of a trope in these kind of films, but I think that does have parallels with what apparently happened.
If anything, Annabelle lifted it. This was like straight out of the original.
One of the big differences between the movies is you can really see the budget constraints of the entity in comparison to Poltergeist.
Yes.
The thing is the use of that, I don't know if I want to call it music, but that sort of repetitive rhythmic beat. Entity would show up, haunted me from
it's
the
jarring.
When I saw this in the 80s. It's anytime I hear anything like that, I think of this movie, and it was so well used and terrifying.
It really evoked those
feelings.
There is a Jimi Hendrix song that has that kind of a beat, and I can't think of which one it is. I should have tried to
Purple
listen
Haze.
To it beforehand.
Purple Haze.
No. Oh. That's the only one you know.
What do you mean?
But it has that same kind of beat. Every time I hear that, I kind of taken right back to that movie. In the movie, they explain that as being a pipe.
That was actually the sound of something moving, this little
scraping sound.
Well, that was the pipe.
I guess we're not too sure if the others were experiencing that sound.
I don't think that sound was meant to be something that was heard in the house. It was only something to evoke that emotion in us, the watcher. Just like, in most movies, they don't hear the score playing.
For our cinemaphiles, this was a non-diegetic sound. That's what...
yes.
There's this idea of like when sounds come from within them, like the pipe scraping, that's diegetic. Mm-hmm. It's happening. The people hear it and we hear it.
You can digest it.
Right.
I think it's automatic.
Yes, exactly. It's like a biscuit. Yeah. So no, but that thumping, I think that was all supposed to just make us unsettled, to sort of put us in the same sort of psychological space as the victim here.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think
it worked well.
In talking about the movie, I think we should talk about the home environments and the family structure as well. So you have this single mother. And later on, they do talk about the background behind the, I think there were two fathers for the three children. In the true story, sometimes I've heard that there were three children or there were four children. Sometimes that there were three boys or four boys and one girl. Movie, there are two girls, young girls, and one older boy who is, I think he's 16.
16,
And again, she's about 30 herself. But I think that the relationship that they seem to have is a good one in the movie, at least to begin with. But the son is kind of lumbered with the responsibility of taking care of the two young girls while the mother's at work or studying, and he's having to cook and clean. So I think that there's some resentment there.
Yeah, and he just wants to be a teenager.
Yeah, and he's having to take care of the two girls. He's basically being the father. Right? He's being the adult in a lot of this movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, he really is. Yeah. And I think he's kind of her connection to normality too, which is something that the psychiatrist keeps referring to, that she needs to have someone to keep her grounded in this, whether it's her boyfriend or I don't know, maybe him. There's a kind of a weird thing going on there.
Yeah.
I mean, he never outrightly says anything, but certainly towards the end, he says that he cares about her repeatedly.
Really care about what happens to you.
Yeah.
This is good with the L word.
This is Ron Silver as Phil Snyderman, Dr. Phil Snyderman. Silver plays a lot of slimy characters, and I think he's supposed to be a good guy here, but he really comes across as sleazy. Yeah.
He's good with the sleaze.
Yeah, he really does. But with the home, I think that they cast the home very well, because if you go and look at pictures of the actual house.
Yes, totally agree.
It's a real dead ringer for that. They're same color, same kind of structure.
It was the best casting, I think, in the whole movie.
It's solid. Did you notice, I just pay attention to these things sometimes, but in film, there's this idea of something called the Dutch tilt, where you put the camera on a little bit of an angle and it's supposed to be kind of offset things and make you feel a little bit unsettled. They use it all the time in this film. I mean, like
front to back. Yeah.
Every time she's walking towards the house, it's tilted one way or the other. And like there's scenes where, you know, when something serious has happened, suddenly there's a little bit of a tilt.
Mm-hmm. So filmed very well. The cinematography was really great.
We were talking about last night about how fun the scene was when she was looking for her car keys and the camera was on the car keys the whole time.
Yes. Yes.
That was a lot of fun.
Oh, the things with mirrors. For them,
even when she reached for them, you couldn't tell the perspective, whether she was in front of it or behind it. Uh-huh.
And it's almost like a jump scare from her own hand reaching for the keys. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But to go back to the house, I mean, it was run down on the inside and I think it was maintained as well as it could be. In comparison to the true story, where it seems like the house was really in a state of disarray, and apparently Matt and I kept hearing that the place had been condemned
twice.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's true or not, and I guess we'll get into this a bit later too about the history of the place.
Go ahead, Karen. I'm sorry.
No. I was really just kind of wanting to describe the house, but
yeah.
Done. Well, one of the things that I noticed about the movie was right out of the gate, she is assaulted. They're showing, here I am at work and here I am in my night classes and here I am kind of, now, son, you need to do things right. I love you. And then that's all happy. And then boom.
Boom, boom, boom. Yeah.
She's assaulted immediately.
10 minutes.
That's interesting thing. In the last 10 seconds of that 10 minutes, we had multiple things happening. The first thing is the stuff on the counter starts, or the her little armoire that starts vibrating. And then immediately she smells something bad and immediately she's cold. And it was just like, boom, boom, boom. I mean, it was just so rapid fire. All that happened within the space of 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, they are not messing around with this movie. No. They are shoving it down your throat immediately just to show you how harsh this is.
And there were really a lot of those scenes too throughout the movie. I think at least we counted maybe about 6 scenes. So you really just couldn't.
Of the assault, yeah.
Yeah, so you couldn't really rest at any point throughout the movie. It was just, it kept you in this constant state of fear.
It constantly disoriented and anxious. There's a thing that happens in a lot of sort of haunted house movies where you're like, wait a minute, why don't they leave? Right. And really early in the film, they also show you that she can't run away from this. It's with her everywhere she goes.
Yeah.
I thought that's from a storytelling perspective, that's powerful. That's a clever bit of a way to keep you, like, at least there's a reason why they're staying, you know?
Well, yeah. And then the
order in which they were placing things was very well thought out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she did attempt to leave in the movie after that first incident and went and stayed with a friend. and the friend's husband or partner wasn't very happy about that and tried to boot them out the next morning. And then she came to stay with them, which I thought was strange. I mean,
Her friend and her friend's husband are extremely dysfunctional, and he comes across as like one of the larger a-holes in horror cinema, I think.
She seems to have a southern accent and
has
a southern hospitality going.
When he said that, I'm going to go in there and set her straight, you know, and then boom, they're out the door. Out the door before he can do such a thing. But
we don't even see him. Yeah, he's just his voice.
Yeah, disembodied voice. Speaking of disembodied voices, the only time the entity speaks, he graces us with the C word, but I want to know who that voice was, because it sounded like Clancy Brown from Highlander.
it did a bit. Yeah.
Like, welcome home. You know, it was just sounded like, you know, Kurgan from Highlander, the way he said it and everything. So I was wondering who voiced that, because I actually did not take the time to go look. So in the comments, somebody let me know who voiced that.
But she does attempt to leave. And so I did think it was strange that the friend came back and then stayed with her, you know, at this place after she's been assaulted. And in real life, too, she does. I don't think she attempts to leave at first. I think the paranormal researchers that she works with do try to convince her to leave. And she finally does and moves into another house that's in California. And have we said that this is in Culver City?
Yes. Well, we haven't, but it is.
No. And
we're kind of mixing between reality and the movie, but
Which I think is kind of probably the best approach with this particular film. So she does move somewhere else, and the phenomena follows her. So it said that it's attached to her. And then she eventually moves to Texas and just kind of disappears. And it said that the phenomena the activity decreases in severity and the incidents over time. But I suppose we should talk about just some of the phenomena anyway that happens in the movie. And as Matt said, you really do get exposed to that just in the first 10 minutes. It's very full on. And then I guess it really comes into play a lot more when she meets the paranormal investigators. And at first they come across as skeptical, don't they?
They were not just skeptical. They were mocking. And
they really were.
I made that comment last night to Karen. I was like, anytime somebody comes to you with some sort of phenomenon, the first thing you think is, I am the person that needs to make her feel better. Hmm. You know, so you're going to listen and you're going to go, you know, you're not going to, you know, you can ask some questions and things like that, but you have to really think about putting somebody off immediately when you want to be able to go and investigate this. We really, you know, especially during this time in history, there weren't very many claims coming in. As soon as reality TV started up with it, suddenly there's claims like crazy and everybody wants to get on TV. So everybody's saying, my house is haunted, me. But back then it was not such a big deal. So if these researchers had somebody come to them, they were going to treat her well, you know, and with kid gloves. And in the movie, they were like a tremor, maybe, you know, I mean, it was just, they were so sarcastic and snarky, and until an actual tremor seemed to hit the house and scare the wits out of them.
And they become eyewitnesses. But I think that there's some validity to that as an explanation. I mean, obviously not in the film, it's fictional, but in
real life,
in terms of possible natural explanations for that particular aspect of what was going on in the house, with some paranormal, poltergeist activity that was taking place in the house, with objects falling over and cupboards opening and closing. And at one point, a frying pan flew across the room.
Took a ballistic arc, according to Barry Taft.
No evidence of that. But certainly a lot of the things falling over and the damage in the house, too.
But they said the place was, not only a pigsty, but in bad structural shape. So if you consider a tremor, which happens daily in California.
Oh, hundreds every day.
You know, they're all the time. If you've got a house that has bad structure in the first place, those tremors might feel a little more drastic than a house that's actually built for that kind of, natural occurrence. So
I wonder, the house is still around today. It is painted. It looks
I have some photos. In fact, I was going to go through just a couple of photos here and discuss
them.
They
may have reinforced the structure or something like that nowadays, but it is interesting that it's still around.
It is. It's very interesting. Okay. Are you guys able to see that? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So now when you do a search for the entity online, this is one of the photos that comes up often. And it's like, this is a claim of one of the photos they took. Well, it's not. This is a classic ghost photo back in the more spiritualism days. One of the real giveaways on it is look how high the ceiling is, you know, and the chandelier up there and the molding going around the room at the top there. Now, if you were to look at the house, those ceilings aren't high.
No, and the interior shots,
not going to have that
very low.
Yeah, that crown molding and all that is not going to happen. So, but this is the house. And as you can see, it's, you know, now we've got the nice stucco finish on it and everything else that it didn't have at the
it's
time.
It's different again now. I think it's painted red and brown, or you've got a picture.
Yeah, it's right there.
Oh, they're not red and orange and
orange
gray.
And gray.
there we go.
But this is the house. It was tiny. And in the movie, they portrayed so many people in this house. And the stories are, you know, that there were 40 some people in the house. You couldn't fit 40 people in this house. It just
well, what if they were clowns?
Oh.
That's
and they
a good
were.
Point.
They kind of were. But the thing is, you know, all of the photos that we see only have maybe four or five people in.
That's them. True.
Yeah. You know, at the most.
There
so there's a lot of stuff we don't really know about this. Now, when we talk about classic ghost photos, we have like this one. What was this?
The brown lady.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, these are easy to make. I mean, here's one where Karen plays the brown lady.
Oh, yes.
As we're going downstairs. So you can see that you did not need Photoshop to make ghost photos then. And what why the reason I'm bringing this up is we had Barry Taff saying, oh, she said that the ghost was over in the corner. So we took a picture of the corner and this is what we got with our Polaroids. And then it was, she said, oh, it's in front of my face. Look, it's in front of my face. And we took a picture and this is what we got. And then she said, it's not in front of my face anymore.
Yeah.
And this is
and that's what
they what got.
I was talking about with the discernment too, that she knew the positioning of this entity.
Yes. Yes. She could tell where it was, but no one else could. Now, the thing is that the scratches on the photo were actually made by Barry Taft. It was an accident. So the scratches don't mean anything. But and I'm also looking at her hair. We're looking at, this is kind of the hairstyle Dolly Parton had around this time. It's very big. But when we get into, well, it's very big. It's a very big hair. Let me step back here to these photos. Okay. This is somehow proof, all these photos. So let me show you really quickly.
I think she does tend to look different in different photographs, which makes me wonder about which one is her actual identity.
That's what I was going to show next. But first, I wanted to say that today, Blade, our son, came up and said, oh, there's a ghost in front of me. And I took a picture and I got this. Oh, my goodness. And then he said, OK, the ghost is gone now. And I got that. So it's amazing how that works. You know, there's a ghost. And there's not a ghost. I can take those two with a
can
cell
be replicated.
Phone.
It's like gone in a flash. That's amazing.
It's gone in a flash. Well, the thing is they're both taken with a flash, but there is a secret to it. Now, it is harder with a smartphone because they are smart when it comes to photos. And that is, if you are taking a picture and you hold your hand like this, it reflects the flash back down into the lenses. And it's a very common ghost hunting thing. Because you want to be able to see the orbs to show, you know, the ghosts. So you kind of cup your hand over it. And this was actually a technique that was supposed to be a ghost hunting technique, not a fraud technique, but a ghost hunting technique. No, that causes the light to come back down over the lens. So you get, you know, this lovely flare over the picture, you know. Mm-hmm. And I can guarantee, and especially when we're talking about Polaroids, that's going to totally be an issue. So, yeah, that doesn't work.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I'd seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww. Yeah.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
But let's go back really quickly to this. And it is hard because here they are all with her in this room, and this is what her hairstyle looks like. It's big. Mm-hmm. And then we move on, and suddenly her hair is darker. Mm-hmm. And it's
wavy.
Down. Yeah, it's wavy.
It straight.
It's just more the hairstyle that she had in the movie. But we can talk about this picture too. This is one. Oh, well, it wasn't projected on the wall because there's a corner there and blah, blah, blah. And obviously that's the only way that a picture like this could happen. It's a Polaroid. You can make these kind of things on Polaroids all the time. You put a little, wrinkle in them, a little crimp. It'll do that kind of thing. No problem. But there's also another way to do it. And we were investigating Children's Hospital, and this was, we always get hanger-ons often when we would go out and people would find out we were doing it, so there would always be people around occasionally. But we made this arc over one of those people in one of the rooms that was demolished, and ooh, that's pretty scary looking, isn't it? It's really easy. And you can see, it's not projected onto the wall behind this person. He was just standing there, and we got this arc over the top. Now you can move on, and there we put a little toy there to show the children, the ghostly children of Children's Hospital might play with it. And oh, lo and behold, we get this absolutely incredible interaction with this toy.
Yeah.
So what's going on here? This is all in camera, no Photoshop. It's very easy to do. This is done with a slow shutter and a flashlight. So wow. You can paint in the air with a flashlight and then walk away and then flash, trigger the flash on the camera. And this is what you'll get. You can do a similar thing with a laser pointer, and you can
cool.
You can say boo in the air.
800 is what I see. Is that different?
It's I don't have the best ghostly penmanship. I apologize for that. But that's all done in camera. There's no Photoshop. That boo is existing in mid space, in this photo. It's not up against the wall.
And I think that these pictures are better than a lot of the claims that are out there.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know if you can see the face that's in brick. So they had one, I couldn't find it, but they had one where they said that an entity was actually starting to manifest. Yeah, it's not hard to do either, as you can see there.
That could even be pareidolia too, if it wasn't that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, in this case, that is actually my face. It's just not that scary. That's my hand appearing next to the wall. And that's all, like I said, in camera. There's no Photoshop involved. So,
and I think if a lot of people by accident created this kind of phenomena, that they would just construe it as being paranormal.
most of the time, people that think they're paranormal investigators don't know how to use a camera in this sense. So they put it on night portrait mode because that makes sense. They're in the dark, you know, that's how they want to have it. They don't realize that slows down the shutter and then it gives a flash at the end. So suddenly you can have all kinds of crazy photos. And these ones that I'm seeing from the entity do not pass muster. I mean, they were confirmed to be real. Well, they're real photos.
Real photos.
You know, but yeah, not tampered with. No, they weren't tampered with. Yeah. You know, that's all true, but they're not ghost photos. We don't even know what a ghost photo would look like at this point. So I think that's all really important stuff to talk about.
It is. Now, I think the fact that there can be mundane explanations for a lot of the sort of physical evidence in this case and it's important. And it's also, this is one of those rare cases where, and I don't like to say much about this because I think we tend to approach these cases with a presumption of sincerity, that the people who make claims are sincere people. And that, you know, there are people always like, well, you're skeptics, you don't believe anything, or you're always debunking. You always like, don't take, you know, it's like, well, listen to the people's claims. But it is important if people are living in terribly dysfunctional families and are under all kinds of psychological stress. And if even the investigators admit that every time something was going on, the people were incredibly intoxicated. Like there was substance abuse and alcohol issues here. There's a lot going on.
They called her a recovering alcoholic, but she was drunk all the time.
They literally talk about it. If the few times they talked to her sober, nothing happened.
Right.
Like, you know,
she was a victim of childhood abuse too. Yeah. And so she'd had multiple relationships where she was a victim of abuse. But there were claims in with the true story that she'd had some things that had happened to her, some incidents that led to this activity. And one of those was that she'd played with a Ouija board when she was a girl.
See, I play with the Ouija board as well. But
show off.
It doesn't affect me that way.
No, but again, that's just, you know, part of the narrative for these kinds of stories. But another strange incident was that this older Hispanic lady turned up, I think, just after they'd moved into the house. And she warned them that they needed to get out of the house because the house was evil. And it's just interesting to find out that after the events that took place in the house, no one who's ever lived in the house or owned the house since has ever experienced anything.
Now, I do want to say that Blake really, really did a good job of creating a segue for us, Karen, and he didn't even know it. And that was...
Yeah,
we actually had an investigation, Karen and I, that we went on that mirrors this so well.
Yes, strangely it does. And I think, when would this date back to? I think it was before Blade was born, so maybe about 2013?
Yeah, it was 2012, 2013. It was right around that time. And we got a message that this family was in like 911 distress. And Karen was smart enough to go, no, don't go driving up there because you could be met with a shotgun or something.
Yeah.
Well, maybe call 911 then.
Instead of sending a 911 text, why don't you call 911? So we actually sent the police there first to make sure everything was okay. So then it got around that we called the cops on them, which
they hated that. Yeah.
So we came back and said, no, that's not the case. You said 911. You said you were in distress. We were an hour away. We sent you help. And they backed off.
I think that that's more of a reaction that a skeptic would have, though. I think a paranormal group would, oh, great, let's grab our cameras and equipment and go.
Go save the day, because all paranormal investigators just want to be superheroes. That's all it is.
TV stars.
Did the police arrive with smudge sticks and prayers? I don't know just curious.
They arrived with smirks, not smudge sticks.
I think they turned up and said, oh, we were told that the people living here are crazy, which is not. Yeah,
some ghost hunters called us and said, you guys need some help, you know, so it was not good. I mean, the police handled it terribly. They really did. But they're not trained for that.
It's weird that they're not trained for that.
because it doesn't exist. I don't know. But the thing is, we set up a time to go up there when it wasn't a 911 situation to at least have an interview with them and talk to them about things.
Well, I think that they acknowledged in the end, I think they had some other ghost hunting groups come through. And then they acknowledged that what we did was correct based on the information that we had at the time. Right. So yeah, they did invite us back. I think that they'd really gone through a number of groups who either dismissed their claims or who were too scared by the phenomena that was taking place there.
You know, there's kind of a phenomena that happens with reality TV, you know, being such a problem. And that is a lot of these people are paranormal group tourists, and they will call every paranormal group in town just
like
until they get they're shopping until they're window shopping until they get one that tells them exactly what they want to hear. And you know, Barry Taft, Terry Gaynor, they told Doris Bither exactly what she wanted to hear over time. But what happened with us, we got to this house and it was up in up near Greeley, Colorado. We walked in, the place was a disaster, very poorly kept.
Bottles and of alcohol everywhere, including in the teenagers'
children's
room.
Well, yeah, one of them wasn't a teenager, but yeah, they were young. One of them, I think, was 13. One of them was 8, maybe. I can't remember. Because
okay, they were even younger.
There was a young girl, and there was a probably 13-year-old boy, 12-year-old boy. There was a lot of empty alcohol bottles in their room as well. We were really getting, and of course, they believed their mother was being raped by a demon often.
And she was covered in bruises and scratches and cuts. The house reeked of marijuana as well. And the place that even painted words on the walls. So, I mean, it clearly seemed like it was a dysfunctional family who were in distress.
The mother was driving the idea of blaming this on the paranormal. And that, of course, got the kids freaked out. So they started experiencing things themselves along with seeing whatever their mother was saying. And the husband was trying to maintain some sort of control, but he had lost it completely. And we're pretty sure that there was an enormous amount of meth use by the mother, who denied all of it.
She had very dark circles under her eyes. And you know, when you see pictures of people who've abused meth and that there's a before and an after picture, I mean, she truly looked like an after shot. She did not look well.
Yeah,
she was. And apparently she'd gone to see, I was urging her to, I mean, she kind of developed a bit of an affinity with me and wanted to talk with me about it. I think she thought as a woman that I would understand what she was going through. But as a skeptic, it was very difficult for me to understand a lot of the things that she was claiming, things like worms coming out of her skin.
Yeah, she was insisting that worms were coming out of her skin. And of course, we couldn't see them. We could see where she had scratched herself, but there were no worms coming out of her skin.
And those are unfortunately symptoms of being a meth addict. And she, as Matt said, had claimed that she had been raped repeatedly by a demon. And I think the father claimed he'd seen this demon at some point too. And she had, of all things, evidence. She had
video evidence.
And I said, well, may I view this? And so she wanted me to see it, but she did not want Matt to see it
or anyone else to see it.
And we spent maybe about an hour going through her files, and she was shaking and in a really terrible state of distress, but also seeming like she was affected by something. She couldn't find anything. I mean, there wasn't anything to my understanding, because she really went through all of her files and was showing me video after video. I mean, comparable to pictures of Bigfoot, really, or video of Bigfoot, not even as good as that, just very blurry footage where it didn't seem like anything was going on. It was just black and white. So there was no evidence, but she was really in the habit of, we try to explain something, giving a natural explanation, and she would just jump down our throats and say, well, how do you explain this? And the things kept getting worse and
escalated. Yeah, she didn't come with her A game. She would like tell us, you know, something about one time I walked in and there was a smell. So we'd you know, say, okay, well, that could have been blah, blah, blah. Oh yeah, well, what about this? And then she would say something that was a little bit more. We'd explain that. And then she'd, well, what about this? And then something a little bit more. I mean, it was 3 hours of that, of her ratcheting it up. And I'm like, well, if that actually happened, why didn't you lead with that? So none of it was believable, but she believed everything she said. Her children believed everything she said, and her husband was along for the ride, seemingly believing most of what she said. And it mirrors the entity so well. And that was the thing. All the paranormal groups that came in the house felt that this haunting was worse than Amityville. And since Amityville was fake, maybe. That's the thing is they talk about all the witnesses in the entity case, and everybody saw this, and the children were seeing this. Yeah, well, we've seen this before, and it's not convincing.
Yeah, go ahead, Karen. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, the story in Greeley really did mirror the Doris Bither case in terms of the phenomena that was happening and the things that they were reporting. So I don't know if they had seen this movie and they were somehow influenced by that, or if it was really a product of people who were, you know, abusing substances, and that this is the kind of thing that happens. Because certainly in the case of Doris, she was known to abuse substances, and a lot of the things that were happening to her were really evidence of that. I mean, she could have been cutting herself. She could have been causing a lot of these bruises and just things that had happened to her. You know, perhaps she was doing them to herself. It really was very similar.
There's that idea of there's the idea of folie à deux, where you've got a shared delusion in a small group of people, and they reinforce their own belief. I feel like, especially with a parent and children, like even though they had a contentious relationship, apparently quite contentious in real life, there is a lot of pressure to believe what your parents tell you. You know, like just like if your parents are undergoing a lot of weird, terrible stuff, and they tell you it's because of X, you know, whether that's ghosts or demons or you're being persecuted by some outside conspiracy or whatever.
If you're a kid, you don't want to be the reason things are going wrong,
right?
So, and you're go along with
exactly. And you're not these are your caregivers. You're not supposed to be like a mystery solver trying to figure out what's really going on, you know?
And I think there's another term for that too, collective hallucinations, where we see cases of Marian apparitions, so multiple people. I mean,
UFO sightings are very big for that.
Very similar to that definitely. Too, or multiple people thinking that they have seen a ghost. I think collective hallucinations are another possible explanation for that. And in the true story too, and in the movie, the eldest son, Bill or Billy, he at one point has his arm broken when he goes to rescue his mother during one of the incidents where she's being raped. And the movie does get a little bit weird, apparently, in some of the cuts. And I think that the doctor suggests at some point that she might have an incestuous relationship with her son, or
it's everything's super Freudian in this film. Like, I mean,
psychiatry.
But I do, just jumping back to the Greeley thing really quickly, I just want to say it's my personal opinion that so much of this was driven by the fact that she was trying to cover up her and even give herself excuses for her meth addiction. That's what it really seemed. It's like it was all about covering up what she was doing.
So she was not a sound mind.
And everything was meth-sterious phenomena?
That is not one of your best.
Okay, well, I'll just keep railing on until I get to that.
It didn't make me laugh, though.
But there's another explanation which is commonly given too, and that is that Doris and Carla in the movie suffers from sleep paralysis. And I think that there are some parts of the film where that's kind of implied. And certainly in the true story as well, that a lot of these things happen when she's in bed, these yeah. things happen at night. In the movie too, doesn't she? She has an orgasm at one point.
Which, by the way, that just when I was watching the film, I thought, wow, this is really powerful visual storytelling, because she's clearly sleeping, and they do some incredible Stan Winston actual special effects to like create the like it looks like she's being molested without anybody touching her. And right. I thought, wow. And then she clearly wakes up feeling ashamed and disgusted because it was not consensual. And she had the pleasure of the orgasm, but the horrible violation of having been molested. I thought, that's really powerful storytelling. Yeah. You know, I'm picking up all this. Then the next scene, she literally says all that out loud. I was like, you didn't need to do that. It was so well done.
Yeah. You know, anyway, and that does actually happen sometimes in cases of true sexual assault. And that, asking for it, or she enjoyed it.
It makes it so shameful. Like for the people who experience it, it feels so terrible to have to deal with the violation and
more
the,
so.
Yeah. So
and the natural reaction. But I do want to add too, and this is something that I think makes me feel a little bit better about those scenes, because they are distressing. But to find out that body doubles were used and mannequins were used. And I think the one in that scene towards the end that the boyfriend witnesses when he comes back home, they used a mannequin then. And apparently that cost about $65,000 for them to make. So that must have been a big chunk of the budget going towards that.
That's that Stan Winston magic. I think that's
where you see the impressions on her breasts and like she's being touched
behind the scenes. Crying. Yeah, it's a body cast. And then inside it, they've got suction cups that can pull in and push out the skin. So yeah, it's very impressive. And so it's a full body within her head strategically placed against it. It's the same way they do the pulling people apart effects in zombie movies, like famously in Day of the Dead, for example.
And she's whispering, help me. And it's very distressing.
It was very distressing.
Even going back to that Greeley case, the video footage that she showed you seemed to be nothing more than sleep paralysis from what I remember you telling me about it.
Well, it looked like they had a camera set up in the course of the night, but it was very blurry and it really didn't seem like anything was taking place. There was just nothing graphic, nothing clear at all. Mm. And I think it was just she was showing me bits and pieces of that footage, like we see in a lot of paranormal movies or even people trying to recreate phenomena or doing, you know, kind of home jobs, ghost hunting, stuff like that. But there, from what I could see, there was just absolutely nothing compelling, which is good.
Well, I thought there's a scene in the movie when Dr. Snyderman confronts her and basically says, look, what you're experiencing has happened throughout history. People have been assaulted by what they think are paranormal entities. And he pulls out this notebook and it's got all these clippings of like medieval stuff and monsters. And I thought it's so funny because that's such a low budget way to do what they would typically do with like a mocked up book. But his point is completely valid, that what she's describing is the same thing as incubus and succubus and sleepy demonic attacks. And those are real things that people experience as supernatural, but are caused by sleep paralysis. And absolutely. And so if you're listening to this and don't know about that, do look it up. It is something where your body goes, when you go to sleep and are having dreams, you're normally paralyzed.
Or you can go back and listen to a Monster Talk episode.
Yeah, we've talked about it a lot. Yeah.
I do want to talk about, now I don't want this to get confused. I want to talk about the climax of the movie and not the scene we just talked about.
The third act, the movie changes.
Are you aware of how that actually even came to be? Because it is completely fictionalized.
Yeah.
And it's the writer, Frank, when he came to Barry Taft and he said, if you could have done anything, you had all the money and resources in the world and you could have done anything to try to, you know, take this to the next step, what would you have done? And that was what Barry Taft said, is to, you know, try to
build a ghost trap by recreating the house.
You know, isolate the ghost and freeze
in a basketball court. Okay. Yeah.
To so treat the woman as a lab rat.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're just going to dump liquid helium all over you. Yeah. And why was it liquid helium and not liquid nitrogen?
Nitrogen. Yeah. That's, and the thing is what they actually had in the tanks was liquid nitrogen.
Okay.
But they said it was liquid helium. So whatever.
I don't know why. Okay.
Yeah, me neither. You know, they it's fictionalized, so they had to change everything. It's a very weird choice. I mean, what would make you think that you could freeze a ghost? What would make you think that that shield that she stepped behind was going to do anything against the ghost that can go through walls?
And it doesn't.
It ultimately doesn't
protect her.
It was just a very bizarre choice. It really was. And then to have the ghost take control of the nozzle, as it were. So yeah.
I think it's interesting too, in that in other parts of the movie, and this happened in the real story too, that she would provoke the ghost. So she would yell and abuse the ghost, either when she thought that its power was waning, she would abuse it, or to try and coax it to appear, to materialize for photographs. And so I thought it was interesting that in that final scene, the climax scene, that she doesn't, it just appears of its own accord. And it's not brought out in any way that I can see. It just turns up.
Yeah. On cue. Like, again, it was just like hanging out. Was it watching? What are they doing over there?
Was it fooled?
Yeah.
The house is here now.
It would seem like it was an intelligent being or entity, and so that it was kind of lured into that and then trapped, which was a little bit reminiscent of Ghostbusters as well.
I mean Ghostbusters was 84, I think, it was the same time as Poltergeist is being made, but the budgetary differences between the two films is stunning. But still, what really got me is like, well, first of all, it'd be really cool if Parapsychology had those kind of budgets. But usually they were like not even real departments. They were just like kind of adjacent clubs to the psychology.
It was like a club class, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I think it was interesting because in the movie, they said, oh, we're part of psychology.
Yeah.
You know, oh, which department? Oh, parapsychology, which kind of sub-department.
Yeah.
And I did think it was interesting, too, the way that the film ends, where the psychiatrist, who I think is the head of the departments, and he's the mentor of Dr. Schneiderman, and that he witnesses everything, as does the other psychiatrist, and that he basically poo-poos at the end and says, well, it could have been lots of different things.
Which I don't know what I saw.
Yeah, and she's like, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's like that damn evil skeptic. The end ruins everything.
Those who don't believe that no proof is enough. That was really the kind of theme of the movie and the way it ended.
Well said.
Skeptical approach.
But I mean, it's a strange film in that, much like the true story, they did get this part. It never ends. It never ends. There's no solution. Mm-hmm. And that always breaks my heart for the people who are really experiencing these things, because whatever the cause, to not have a resolution, it is trauma and it's recurrent trauma and they're never going to get out of it. And I personally don't think it's supernatural, but it would have taken a lot of work to get somebody out of that mess.
I wonder what happened to, because Doris sadly died in 1999. And so she was about 58 years old, and I think it was cardiopulmonary failure. So a heart attack or, something like that. And I don't think we've ever heard from her children, because if there are three or four children, I'm sure that some of them would still be around. And I don't think anyone's ever come forward to talk about this. It's just kind of faded into obscurity.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I did looking and I couldn't find anything in that sense. But I do have to say that, it's funny because it is well stated that last scene in the gymnasium is completely fictional. And yet I remember talking to Ed Warren and him saying, oh no, I know the head of that department, that woman, I can't think of what her name is off the top of my head, in real life. She's like, and that is 100% true. Everything in that movie was absolutely 100% true.
Yeah,
that's not true.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then that's the fun thing is Ed told me everything I would ever need to know about him in that short conversation.
And I think that's probably just something he would say to everyone. He tells all the boys that.
Yeah,
absolutely true.
Just so he could go on to tell me that Ray Garten's book In a Dark Place was 100% true, which we know from Ray Garten that it is not. Another great Monster Talk episode you should totally check out.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, like a lot of the movies we cover here, this movie, I can't recommend it. Like I can't, like and it's not because I don't think the story is true. It's because I just found that the subject matter so traumatic and I don't, it's weird because what I expected to happen was that a serious topic like sexual assault would be trivialized by injecting the paranormal into it. And what I found instead was, no, it's still terrible and they don't trivialize it, but in a way it's still kind of worse because the real root causes for all the stuff going on are never dealt with except through the proxy of the paranormal. And it doesn't solve anything even in the story. Like it's like, it's a terrible situation. I felt bad for the kids.
She's exploited and she's objectified throughout. And there really is no kind of resolution. And it seems like that draws parallels again to the true story she kept moving on. And this phenomena apparently followed her because I think it was her.
Did you know? Well, I think so too. Exactly. What's the common element? That lady. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not because I think she's the center of a haunting or demonic attack or ghost or whatever, but because she's got serious mental health issues, substance abuse problems.
Troubled.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you notice though in the film, I thought this was a strange choice. Okay. So in real life, we know she was alcoholic, drug using person with many problems, legitimate. Mm-hmm. And I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying she had serious issues that needed to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. But in the film, she never drinks and there's ashtrays all over the house.
Oh, she does at one point when her boyfriend comes home.
Oh, the wine that she tries to.
He brings a bottle of wine.
Oh, no, I'm not going to drink tonight.
It's my homecoming.
That's right. But there's ashtrays everywhere and she never smokes. Like there's ashtrays by the bed. There's like other people are smoking. And oh my God, the scene where the doctors are all talking about her case and like the room's literally filled with smoke. I was like, that's the 80s
as well.
Oh, I know she did. She did smoke once in the movie and that was in the hospital.
Oh, was she smoking there with everybody else?
Well, it was early on in the hospital she was smoking. And that was it though. Yeah. Okay. They really kind of kept that out. But in these movies in this era, they always seem to make sure that the doctors and in hospitals there's plenty of smoking because it was cool and it was glamorous.
It was a manly thing to do.
Well, you know Graham Chapman from Monty Python?
I do.
He had a degree in medicine. He'd gone to it was Cambridge, and he said that he started smoking a pipe originally because he didn't want to be called upon in class to answer questions, and he wanted to look like a doctor, a kind of stereotypical doctor, by always having a pipe in his mouth.
That's funny.
But when I was growing up, no one in my home smoked. And my mother in particular was very anti-smoking, but we always had ashtrays around the house. I think it was for guests.
Right. Because people,
and in those days, people smoked on airplanes and university halls and just everywhere.
There's so much nostalgia for the 80s right now. Like people love the 80s and Stranger Things and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But you can't really accurately convey just how much cigarettes were part of everything. I mean, it's like everything smelled like cigarettes. When you hopped in somebody's car, it smelled like cigarettes. When you go to their house, it smells like cigarettes, you know? So it was pervasive. So that little scene really caught my eye. It's like, that seems very accurate for the 80s.
Anyway, that's
a weird way to end the show. But
one of the other interesting things I want to bring up just before we cut out, and that is all of the psychology aspects, the psychiatry aspects, were also fictionalized. She did not see a psychologist
at any time.
And yet the way they wrote him was interesting because he was not a good psychiatrist.
He was crossing boundaries. Professional and ethical
all the time, and the questions he was asking were not well done. I mean, he was not a good psychiatrist, so it was very interesting. Now of course we like him in the movie because he's so passionate about saving her, but it was all inappropriate. It was very inappropriate.
It was like all of the men, and it was like they were fighting over her. Even the paranormal researchers were trying to get rid of him. It was like they were all competition against each other. But I do think that in the true story, she truly should have seen a psychologist, a psychiatrist. I think we'd have a different outcome, maybe.
But I would say any movie with Ron in it has a silver lining. So,
or Andy Garcia, he's the next Ron Silver.
He is.
But on that note, I think we should close off, but we do need
to. We don't want to talk about the fact that Dr. Silverman just parked in the middle of the street.
Snyderman.
He just parks his car right in the middle of the street. And like there's another truck blocking the other direction. Yeah. And then he runs in the house in his very stylish
Volkswagen
vehicle.
Jetta.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know,
it was a rabbit.
You're right. It was a rabbit. And psychologists really made a lot of money in the 80s, apparently, because he was driving.
That was male privilege and male entitlement.
In
the 80s.
Like, hey, get that car. It's okay. I'm a doctor. Oh, sorry, doctor.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah. Yeah.
So make sure that you consider becoming a patron. And that's patreon.com/monstertalk. And also click that like button. And if you haven't already, subscribe.
Yeah, we really appreciate you watching this. And I hope that you enjoyed it. And love hearing from you guys in the comments and emails, and just if you'd like to suggest future shows, either for the regular podcast or for Based on a True Story or Monster Talk Live too. Love to hear from people.
All right, everybody, have a great one. We'll talk to you soon.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard a podcast rebroadcast of our YouTube series, Debased on a True Story, covering the film The Entity. We've covered quite a few movies in our series, and if you enjoyed this episode, you might want to check those out at youtube.com/monstertalk. At Monster Talk, we're always looking into mysteries, but there's one mystery which only you can provide the answer for. Who are you? Airwave Media is doing a network-wide audience survey, and we would love to learn more about you, our listeners, the people who make this show possible with your support and attention. Just go to surveymonkey.com/r/airwave, all one word. So that's surveymonkey.com/r/airwave. But don't worry, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Select Monster Talk from the drop-down list of shows and then fill out the simple questions to tell us more about who you are. We hope to hear from you. That's surveymonkey.com/r/airwave. Thanks. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. We'll be back with fresh new content next week. But we're proud of all this video work we've been creating in addition to the podcast, and especially we want to thank Matt Baxter for all his production work on this content outlet. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks once more for exploring the mysterious world with us. We love your company.
Been a Monster House presentation.